Roundtable Podcasts, underwritten by Proctors, the Capital Region's premier performing arts center featuring the best in entertainment from Broadway and around the globe. Proctors.org.
Nobody knows more about this Richie Neal than you do. And so I want you to tell us about the sequester and where we are. But let me start with a theory. My theory is both sides basically wanted it. But now it's the blame game because we are so in debt. Am I wrong?
I think that's an accurate description. Sequester simply means setting aside already appropriated funds, and that means you would be revisiting the budget process well into the budget process. And it was a procedure that I saw as being a gimmick, and I opposed it. And I think that members of Congress are elected to pick and choose amongst the competing priorities. And in this instance here, the incentive that was developed by the administration and by the Republican congressional majority essentially went like this, that Republicans will never go along with an 8% cut in defense spending, and that Democrats will never go along with cuts to domestic spending. And that was supposed to impel the two sides to an agreement. The problem is that neither side blinked as we came down the home stretch and the negotiations fell apart. Republicans would say it was the incendiary language from the White House. The White House would say that they had no interest ever in striking a deal. What I think is fascinating about the press reports, and the president, as you know, is now up to the Hill to do some personal lobbying, but what I think is incredible about this, it's the administration that has put the entitlement programs on the table. And if you remember that the base of the Democratic Party was opposed to putting the entitlement programs on the table for negotiation and deliberation. So the strident rhetoric is still all around us. Both sides now are, I think, locked in. The only light that I see in terms of potential for an agreement could be a conference committee. And a conference committee is really inside baseball, but it's the Congress that I came to that was structured along what we call the regular order, or using very important parts of the legislative process to accommodate a final agreement. And it's important to know that the conference committee was part of it. And the conference committee essentially would say that the House would pass a version of a budget, and then the Senate would pass a version of the budget, and the House and the Senate would get together and, for the purpose of conferring, try to find an agreement. So while the two sides are far apart right now, it strikes me that there is at least some room as we move into the latter stages of spring and summer to talk about how we might find a path forward.
Now, Paul Ryan comes out with his budget. It's immediately KO'd by the White House and saying nothing doing. He wants to get rid of basically the Obama health program. I'm fascinated by that. Is this politics or policy that's going on?
Well, much of this is politics. And remember that the opening salvo in a budget negotiation is outlining what you might consider to be your ideal position. But when you drill down to the Ryan budget, I know Paul very well. He's on my committee, and I've debated him many, many times.
Do you like him?
Personally, I do. I have had a lot of fun tweaking some of the proposals and plans he's had over the years, and I think I've been able to do it with a lot of confidence, to be frank. And one of the things that he does in his budget proposal that has not received a lot of attention is, firstly, he accepts the Medicare cuts that he alleged that Obama embraced during the course of last year's presidential campaign. And remember, the argument that we were offering was that what we were doing was putting that Medicare money back into the system. So he maintains that. And the second thing he does, despite their consternation, is he keeps the tax increases that the president negotiated with them over the debt ceiling. So you're right when you say, in terms of your description, is this politics? It's very much politics, because he uses those two numbers to get to his final position after having inveighed against them for the better part of a seven-month presidential campaign and well into the 3 months of this year.
I saw Rachel Maddow saying basically the details. Details, please. I mean, how are you going to do this, collect all this money, the $4 trillion that he says he's going to collect in 10 years, because you're not showing it to us, and deriding him for saying, oh, we'll show you later.
Well, remember the budget forecasts here, they assume certain economic positions that sometimes are not based upon fact as much as they're based upon speculation. If you had economic growth right now that was running north of 3.5%, 4% per quarter, you would have job creation in the vicinity of up to 300,000 new jobs a month.
Mm-hmm.
One of the difficulties we've had is that the economy has been growing by anywhere from 1 to slightly over 2% per quarter. And even with a good jobs report last week of 236,000 jobs, you have to take into consideration that there are 150,000 people that retire.
Okay.
So, quick point, but I think it bears noting. If, in fact, the unemployment rate right now were 4.5% to 5%, a post-war norm, then one-third of these deficits would go away on their own. And I say that based upon personal income tax revenue going up, capital gains going up, and pressure on social spending going way down. Now, during the course of the campaign, if you recall, Governor Romney said that there were 47 million Americans receiving food stamps. That's an accurate number. The problem is, I don't know, and I've not ever met anybody who said, I can't wait to quit my job to get food stamps.
Right.
That's the challenge. So that's the pressure on social spending that has driven some of these budget deficits. It would be a lot easier, I think, if we postponed some of the excitable language, proceeded to a year out to see what this economy would look like, and stop these ultimatums that we keep delivering. They're artificial, they're manufactured, and they have backfired on the parties that have advocated them.
There was an election. The Democrats won the election. It's, in terms of the way that our national elections go, is almost a near landslide. I think 5% is defined as a landslide. And yet, Ryan does what he's doing. And when I said politics before, I really meant presidential politics, because it's not unknown that the vice presidential candidate on the losing side then tries to run for president, you know, the next time. Is that what this is all about?
I think that's part of it. And I think the second part of it is that's very disturbing is that the two parties now hew to very base instincts in an effort to keep the base happy. So Ryan's position in terms of this budget proposal, which everybody knows is going nowhere, including Paul, what he's attempting to do is to massage the base of the Republican Party.
Where he may have to face a primary.
Where he might have to face a primary. That's precisely correct.
Yeah, that's so interesting. The last thing I wanted to get clear with you was that the so-called entitlements. When I think of entitlements, I think of Medicare, I think of Social Security. Are those on the table, according to Ryan, or are there other entitlements?
Well, he would also include cuts in Medicaid spending, and he would include cuts to the Affordable Care Act. He would now treat that as an entitlement expenditure. Remember that it was President Bush and the Republican Party that offered the prescription drug benefit entitlement program. He didn't mention that. And his proposal on Medicare is essentially to provide a voucher for Medicare, meaning you would get X number of dollars that would be prescribed by formula, and then you would be encouraged to go out and purchase your own private health insurance. I have encouraged Nancy Pelosi and the administration. I talked to Jack Lew just a couple of days ago, who's an old friend of mine. He worked for Tip O'Neill and for Joe Moakley, the new Treasury Secretary. And during the course of a conversation about a series of tax issues, I cautioned him about doing anything that I thought overreacted to the challenge of Social Security. Social Security is in no imminent danger. And that's a very important consideration. And that is based upon actuarial reality and fact, not opinion.
Then why would we raise, Richie, the age limit if, in fact, it's in no trouble?
Well, one of the things that we've done with Social Security is we are raising the age of eligibility by 1 month every year. And I should say for optimal benefit, that's not a change in the sense that you can still draw down the benefit at 62. You simply draw down a smaller number of dollars. For me, it would be an optimal benefit at 66. That's a consideration, because recall, the longer you postpone the benefit, the bigger the benefit.
Sure.
So we've already done that, and the Social Security Trust Fund is in pretty good shape, despite all these discussions trying to scare people about the problems that confront Social Security. And Social Security, as you know, the average benefit is only $14,000 a year. That's not a lot of money. That's less than $300 a week.
No, it's not a lot of money. And it was really never intended, right, to be your only sustenance.
It was never intended to be the sole source of income during your retirement years, but it was guaranteed to be predictable. Yeah. And right now, if you're a 40-year-old male or female, if you call a Social Security office, they will tell you what you're going to receive at a date certain. It's an extraordinary accounting system.
It really is. Well, Richie Neal, we love having you here. And when we come back the next time, I want to talk to you about your new district, okay?
Delighted to do it.
Yeah.
Thank you.